Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Holy Week is underway for Christians here and around the world. And today on Studio Tulsa, we give you a preview of the upcoming University of Tulsa presidential lecture coming up later this week with a biblical scholar whose work has demonstrated that Christianity in its infancy was nearly as diverse as Christianity today. Elaine Pagels is a professor of religion at Princeton University, a recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship, or often referred to as the Genius Grant. She's best known for her studies, research, and writings on the Gnostic Gospels, a collection of around 54 ancient texts on the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth and the early Christian church, including one of the oldest written Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas. All were rejected from the biblical canon and pronounced as heretical in the 4th century. Pagels' book on the subject, The Gnostic Gospels, was a National Book Award winner and the National Book Critics Circle Award winner of that year, 1979. Her other books include Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, The Origin of Satan, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, Reading Judas, The Gospel of Judas, and most recently, Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She'll be giving the University of Tulsa's presidential lecture this Thursday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center, and the event is free and open to the public. Elaine Pagels joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Elaine Pagels, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's been 70 years since the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Library of Gnostic Texts, and I'm wondering, are we still gaining new understandings of these texts and new insights about the nature of early Christianity?
Well, you know, it was 30 years after they were discovered that we first published them. And so it's really been a lot less than that in terms of time to investigate them. And second, the final editions, the scholarly editions, were only finished in 2005. So, you know, when we started, as you know, I was told that they were just weird. I mean, my teachers said these are bizarre, strange texts. They have nothing to do with real Christianity. They're the weird heretical gospels. And more now we see that these are just other Christian gospels. And in the early centuries, a lot of Christians were reading, say, the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mark together. So our sense of what Christianity is much wider than it used to be. We used to think it was just this little stream that we call Orthodox, and now we say, wait a minute, this is a huge river here.
When we look at the diversity of Christianity today, we see there's all sorts of sects. You know, every time the church has had a schism, there's been, you know, a split of some sort in the nature of what Christianity is. And today there's this huge diversity of what Christianity is. At least that's how we perceive it. But do the Gnostic texts suggest that diversity of belief was right there at Christianity's beginnings?
That's such an interesting question because, you know, yes, there's a huge diversity. It goes from Pentecostal and Russian Orthodox to Christian Science and Mormonism, you know? I mean, Christianity is a wide sweep. People define it differently. But we used to think, I mean, the fathers of the church always said, yes, but in the beginning it was all simple and it was all one group and the book of Acts in the New Testament says all Christians were in the same, you know, one heart and one soul. It was a perfectly united group. That just doesn't work when we look at all the sources they eliminated to make that claim plausible.
And it gives a sense of the variety of the belief of early Christians. You know, I think most Christians who have studied the early church know of the divide between what I'm going to call the James Jewish Christian
yes.
Church and Paul's sort of approach to other peoples, the Gentiles, if you will, that divide, but were the divides far more profound than that?
Yes, they really are. And the reason you mentioned that one is important. You know, that's a big divide between followers of Jesus who saw him in continuity with their Jewish traditions and those who didn't. But that's in the New Testament, right? Paul wrote that in his letter to the Galatians. We know about that because it's in the New Testament, but there's so many other discussions. For example, how do you interpret Paul's letters? And now we find some of these other texts that got buried and burned interpret Paul's letters in a really different way than the way we used to. So there are many different ways of understanding those early sources that we just didn't know about.
Now, when we think of a lot of Paul's letters, it's all about we have a central belief. We need to all come together. I mean, there's ones towards the fragmented churches. And are we to think that maybe some of those fragmented churches were reading other gospels and saying, well, no, maybe this is not the right, this is the way to go.
Well, that's right, but they could also be reading the same Gospels and reading them differently. But Paul says, look, if anyone preaches another Gospel than the one I preach, let him be cursed, even if he's an angel from heaven. That's the beginning of Galatians. And he's talking about Peter and James, disciples of Jesus. So he says they're teaching another Gospel. So even among the people we know about, there are different ways of understanding the message of Jesus. The question is, who is Jesus anyway? What is the good news? What is the gospel? And that's not an easy question to answer because different people have different views.
Well, when we think back to the early church, we think of the universal church. Once it became Romanized, and of course then you had the first split with Byzantium, but we think of it as a pretty simple orthodoxy. When did that diversity that was apparent in the early church, or not even to the church, when it was the early beliefs and when these writers were writing these Gnostic Gospels and documents that were at Nag Hammadi, when did that begin to dissipate?
Well, we think they were written, within 100 years of the death of Jesus. Most of the Gospels were. And Christians were reading a whole range of texts until nearly 400 years later. That is, it's almost the end of the 4th century when people are still arguing, bishops are still arguing about what books to include in what they're going to call the New Testament. So there are 27 books, but there's 5 different, maybe 14 different lists of what ought to be included. So everybody pretty much says, well, yes, Matthew, that goes in. Luke, Mark, we all know those. Some people say John, most people do. Some people add other texts. So it's not till the end of the 4th century when you've got an imperial decree from Constantine, now a Christian emperor, who says to his right-hand bishop, well, I want a copy of all the scriptures. And the question is, what goes in and what doesn't? So that's nearly the year 400.
But even prior to that, even within the 3rd century, you have bishops that, if it doesn't make their list, it's roundly denounced and totally described as heretical, as opposed to, well, this doesn't make the cut. I mean, there was no gray.
Well, there were some that would say, well, there are the legitimate texts and there are the texts they call illegitimate. I mean, the same word is used for illegitimate children. And then there are some that are okay, but they're not scripture. So there was a category for those. But you're right, you're either in or out. And pretty much everybody was pretty adamant. Well, Catholics, Protestants, and many others have been very adamant about their points of view ever since.
Now, in the Gnostic texts, I think I'm probably most familiar with the Gospel of Thomas. And Thomas is a very, very different gospel. I mean, he talks about how to bridge that divide between man and God. And the way he bridges it is by truly knowing oneself, that self-knowledge is knowledge of God. How common was that tenet in the Gnostic texts? Is there a central belief system within all the Gnostic texts, or is there a lot of diversity within the scope of the writings?
Well, I think there really is, as you say, a lot of scope. Even we have over 50 texts that happen to be found, and probably there were just so many more that we know by title, but we never saw them. They got burned up. They got destroyed. So there's diversity among them. But that idea that you mentioned, that if you know yourself, you know God, but it's not an intellectual knowing. It's not like that. It's more like, do you have a relationship with God? And if you understand that you have a relationship with God sort of intuitively, because we're created in the image of God, and you can find a path to God even if you look inside yourself, that's common to a lot of these texts. And it's common to many Christians, actually.
Even the word Gnostic or gnosis is I think a lot of people think of it as knowing or knowledge, if you will, But I think you've said it means something a little different, maybe insight, which is a different version of knowledge.
Exactly. Well, you know, what's really interesting here is that Greek has two words for knowledge. One is the word which means something that you've seen, and it means like seen with the mind, and we get the idea of idea. An idea literally in Greek means something you've seen in the mind, like you have an idea about a table, as Plato would say, right?
Are we talking abstract? The abstract knowledge?
Yeah, that sort of mental knowledge.
Okay.
So they would say that kind of knowing is intellectual, but gnosis is where we get the word recognize. Right? It's the same root. And it means, do you know that person? Do you know who you are? Do you know me? So this is a different kind of knowing, and that's why I translated it insight. It's kind of knowledge of the heart, not the knowledge of the brain. But you see it also if you look at French. There's savoir and connaître, or German has the word for wissen, is knowledge, mental knowledge, and the word for personal knowledge is kennen. In Spanish, it's saber and conocer. So all of these languages have two words for knowing, and one is personal knowing, and the other is intellectual knowing. But gnosis is personal knowing.
Hmm. Now, are most of the texts in Nag Hammadi, do they sort of follow that idea of knowing oneself is a deep self-knowledge, is a knowledge of God, or do the belief systems within those texts vary widely?
There's some variety, but I think you've put your finger on the central theme. That's why they're called Gnostic, and it's usually meant as an insult. But it's not an insult if you take it in the language as they understood the language. Somebody who knows God, it's like being a holy person. You know, it's maybe more like a Buddhist idea that you come to recognize your relationship to the divine on a deep level.
Now, you've written about this connection between the Gnostic writers and Buddhist tradition. Do you think there were any formal connections between the writers of these texts and Buddhist tradition?
Probably, because there were Buddhist missionaries in Egypt at the time that these texts are being written. One of my colleagues is about to go on the Silk Road, you know, which goes from...
Right, the Far East through the Mideast.
Far East to the Roman, what was the Roman Empire then, and many people were traveling. I think there are Buddhist missionaries, and also people who don't like Christians, they call Gnostics, also say that those Indian sages who sit by the Ganges and meditate, they're heretics too. So they know about those people, and they don't like them.
Well, earlier you were mentioning the Gospel of John, and, you know, when... Contemporary Christians are looking at the Gospels in detail, it's pretty easy to see there's this sort of difference between the language of the Gospel of John and the other three Gospels in the Bible. And it's very different in its language and in how Jesus reacts and speaks and in the events itself. And you suggested that John was written in rebuttal to the Gospel of Thomas.
Well, I could have been, you know, and yet, even if it was, and we can't prove it, I think they took similar teaching. Most scholars would agree that they have similar teachings about Jesus, that he's the light, he's the divine light, he shows the way to God, you know, and they take it in different directions. But now it's interesting, because I used to think, because of the differences, that they were just, you know, at odds, but now I also see that Christians in the second century could read them together just compatibly. You see various texts that use John, use Thomas, use a little Paul, and sort of mix it all up the way Christians ordinarily mix up the New Testament writings, not worried too much if they have somewhat different ways of expressing themselves.
You know, I find it interesting that when I was reading about this, I immediately thought, where was Doubting Thomas? Doubting Thomas was in John.
Yes, it's so funny. And the other, Matthew, Mark, and Luke speak about Thomas, but his name is Judas, his given name, and his nickname is Thomas. And it's only in John that he becomes a character to ridicule. I mean, John's gospel says, well, that guy, he doesn't have any faith. Jesus actually came back from the dead and said, Thomas, you know, don't be faithless. Start believing. Believe. And the Gospel of Thomas is not ever talking about belief or faith. It's talking about coming to know. But now I think, you see, I think I've learned something in the last, you know, well, a long time of studying this stuff, that they may not be opposed to each other, as originally I thought, but it could be that John is seen as the elementary teaching, which is about believe in Jesus and have your sins forgiven and be baptized. Then you're saved. And that they would see Thomas as the advanced level and say, well, now, after you have faith and you've become a Christian, you've been baptized, now we'll talk about how to come to know God better. And it's not an accident that the people who loved texts like the Gospel of Thomas were Christians who were trying to deepen their spiritual practice. It wasn't where you start. It was an advanced level text. And John could be the beginning level text. I mean, Paul says in 1 Corinthians, I couldn't teach you people because you were so immature. I just gave you the elementary teaching about Christ crucified. I couldn't tell you the hidden mysteries. So I'm just giving you the basics. That's at the beginning of 1 Corinthians. And these other texts were probably meant, they intended to be advanced level. Now, some people love them, as I like some of them very much. And some of the bishops said, well, this is just bad stuff. So people still read them quite differently.
Right. And you know, you've written that these Gnostic Gospels, these Gnostic texts, often portray sort of, okay, here's a secret belief to understanding the nature of Jesus and his life and his words and works. A lot of these texts have that, don't they?
Yes, and if you look at, you say, well, Jesus taught secretly? Well, why didn't we know that? If you look at the fourth chapter of Mark's Gospel, it says that Jesus taught many things to his disciples privately. And when he was talking to outsiders, he only talked in parables, that he put it in story form that maybe they wouldn't understand. In fact, so that they wouldn't understand. So Mark's Gospel says Jesus taught secretly, but he doesn't tell you what Jesus said. And Paul says he taught people secretly, but you know, he didn't write those things down, because in Jewish tradition, you don't write secret tradition down. You have to make sure the person receiving it is mature enough to understand it, so they just don't get inflated and think, oh, hey, you know, I'm God, or you know, something.
I have the knowledge, yeah, right.
Something naive, you know, I know more than you do. It could make them arrogant if they're not humble enough to be wise.
My guest today is Elaine Pagels, a religion scholar and author of the Gnostic Gospels, The Origins of Satan, and most recently Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She'll be giving the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture Thursday at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I'd like to talk a little bit about your most recent book, about Revelations,
yes.
Written by John, and we believe that to be John of Patmos, very different from the John of the Gospel of John. Who was John of Patmos?
Well, that's a really good question. We don't know much about him, except he says his name is John, and he's writing maybe in the year 90, most likely. So, and tradition later said this was Jesus' disciple, John, and he was just very old. But the writing is so different, entirely different style from the writing of the Gospel of John. So we don't know who he was, and this was debated as early as the year 260 by an Egyptian bishop who said, you know, these are really very different Johns, and I don't know who wrote Revelation, he says, but I do think he's a true prophet. So there's very little we do know.
But we do know that he was a Jew, but was he a Christian? I mean, obviously, he mentions Jesus Christ riding in at the decisive time of Revelation. So was he a sort of a Jewish Christian adherent?
It's a good question. You know, Christians have always said, well, look, it's in the New Testament. He's got to be a Christian. And of course, as you say, he speaks about Jesus a lot. But I just said, I thought, you know, Jesus wouldn't have called himself a Christian, right?
No.
Peter wouldn't have called himself a Christian, or Paul, because they don't use that language, because they just thought, well, of course we're Jews, but we've we found the Messiah. And it's only after their group separates from other Jews that you start calling them Christians, you know, especially if they're not Jews anymore. But this John, like Peter, like Paul, would have probably said, well, I'm a Jew, of course, but Jesus is the one that God sent to rule the world, and he's the Messiah, he died for us, and he will come back and rule the world. But he wouldn't say, I'm a Christian, because that might have meant something different.
Yeah. Now, Revelations was one of many apocalyptic texts that sort of circulated around that time, and I think the understanding is that John may have been a refugee from Jerusalem. We don't know, but certainly he was reacting to the destruction of Jerusalem after the Jewish revolt, when the Romans put down the Jewish revolt. So out of these many apocalyptic texts that appear, why is this one included in the Bible?
That's so interesting, that question. I wondered that too, because, you know, it was recently that I thought, wait a minute, there aren't just other Gospels. There's lots of other Revelations. I used to think the book of Revelation, singular, is the only book of Revelation. But then I began to see there are Jewish books of Revelation, there are Greeks who are giving you prophecy. And then with the secret Gospels, there were found many texts that are called Apocalypse, which just the Greek word for Revelation. But these are not about the end of the world. They're mostly about spiritual breakthrough, you'd say. You know, it's quite different, very interesting.
Well, I've always heard that the book of Daniel was sort of an apocalyptic text. It was, you know, we think of it as a history, really, of what happened when the Jews went into captivity in Babylon. But I've read a lot of scholars that believe, no, they're referring to Rome. Rome was occupying Israel and the Middle East when this was written, and it was written in code.
Probably so, or at least the Empire of Alexander the Great, which later gave way to Rome. I mean, it's a prophecy book, you know, and it's echoed all the time in the book of Revelation. But the book of Revelation is written by somebody who's deeply immersed in the book of Daniel, the book of Ezekiel, the book of Isaiah, Jeremiah, because he echoes all of those images in the language, and he kind of updates it to talk about the way he felt that Jesus had said the end of time would come, and this author wants to say, yes, don't give up. It's been a long time since he said that, but it will come, and he will bring justice to the world, just like he said.
Of course, what's happened with Revelations, as you know, is that it's been used to predict everything from who's going to win the Civil War in America to World War II to more recent adventures in the Gulf and everything in between. And are we fairly certain that John was writing about Rome?
Well, you know, you could argue it two ways. You could say in his own time he was writing about Rome. He makes it really clear. But that doesn't mean the prophecies have only one meaning. So many people have said, well, of course, he could have been writing about Rome, and it also means something else. And I was asking myself, you know, how can people read a book 2,000 years old in 2016 and think it's prophesying what's happening today? And I got really interested and then realized that the way he writes with these images of the beast, the monster, the dragon, the whore of Babylon, signs in the sky and cosmic war, these become sort of images that almost anybody can interpret conflict in any time, and people have done it for 2,000 years. It's totally fascinating.
In fact, you write that the reason this revelation is in the Bible, as we know, the canon, is because of Bishop Athanasius.
Athanasius, yes.
Yes.
Well, it isn't only him, because I think other Christians in the 2nd and 3rd and 4th century, especially before the empire became Christian, Christians, as you know, were being persecuted. They were being tortured. They were being killed by the Romans for not worshiping the Roman gods. And so they loved John's book, which is a book about persecution and suffering. Because John prophesies that even though the world is in terrible shape and there's suffering and persecution, eventually God will prevail and justice will come, and that promise is one that people suffering even today still want to hear.
Mm-hmm. But you do write that this bishop really used Revelation as a sort of a heretical stick, if you will, between good and evil.
Well, the problem is that the book of Revelation says that God is going to destroy the Roman Empire.
Right.
And it didn't happen that way. It said the empire became Christian. So some people said, well, hey, this book, the prophecy is wrong. And he was the first bishop who said, well, wait a minute. You can reinterpret it. It doesn't have to mean Rome. I mean, the beast, the monster, could represent heresy. That is, the people whose teaching I don't like.
And getting back to the Gnostic Gospels, that's why we only discovered these texts 70 years ago, because of that fight against heretics. These texts were buried rather than destroyed.
That's right. So that's fascinating to me, because, you know, now it's like we can look at the other side of the moon. You know, we can see a lot about the early Christian movement we just didn't know was there, and it makes it so much more interesting to see how Christians, various Christians, were interpreting the message of Jesus very early, and then which versions of those traditions, which Gospels survived and became part of the canon. They're fascinating as they are, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But the others add a lot to the way we understand what's going on there.
Well, we look forward to your address at the University of Tulsa for the presidential lecture. Elaine Pagels, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Biblical scholar Elaine Pagels speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's a professor of religion at Princeton University, the author of numerous books, including her award-winning The Gnostic Gospels. Her most recent book is titled Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She'll be giving the University of Tulsa's presidential lecture this Thursday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. It's sponsored by the Darcy O'Brien Endowed Chair, and it's free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.